We're going to bring the housing committee to order here. We're going to wait for a few members to bring up the bill because I want to make sure we have a really good discussion on that. So let's start with our presentation from Habitat for Humanity, and then we'll go to the bill that I have. Is that okay? Anyway. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Members, my name is Kristen Beckman. I'm the Government Relations Director for Habitat for Humanity in the Twin Cities. What the staff is passing out right now is a packet that I just sort of wanted to talk folks through as part of the presentation. The first piece is just sort of a quick about Twin Cities Habitat. We're the largest affiliate in the state. There are many affiliates all across the state, Rochester, Brainerd, and all corners of the state. We are the fifth largest Habitat affiliate in the country. We have done about 737 homes with partner families. And typically, you know, I think people are very familiar with our model of volunteers help build the homes. We sell the homes to partner families for 0% mortgage. They do their down payment in sort of sweat equity. They spend either 300 or 500 hours, depending on the size of the building, helping volunteers build the facility, and then they own a home. And Habitat is both the developer and the lender. It's our mortgage product, and we hold the note on it so that we can make sure that it is affordable. And we set the mortgage rate at 30% of the partner family's income. And when the home, if the homeowner decides to move or they want to sell, we have first right of refusal on the house. And so the house comes back to Habitat, and then we're able to work with another partner family and return another low-income family into an affordable unit of housing. And we do this to ensure the long-term affordability of the unit. And you'll see, in addition to this model of homeownership development, we have two other programs. One's called A Brush with Kindness. We work with volunteers and Valspar Foundation to help homeowners stay in their homes, mainly elderly or disabled who are maybe having a hard time keeping up the outside of their house. City licensing offices will let us know who is sort of in code infractions, who's not keeping up the outside, maybe a gutter needs to be put back on. If they're a certain income level, then our volunteers will go out and paint the house, put the gutter back on. So they help a family or a homeowner stay in their home. The other thing that we're doing right now that is taking up a lot of work is we have we're foreclosure prevention counselors as well. We have the grant from the city of Minneapolis to do foreclosure prevention counseling, and so we are actively working with homeowners and their lenders trying to negotiate affordable mortgage payments so that folks can stay in their homes. So, you know, not only are we trying to produce new units of housing, we are trying to keep people in the housing that they have right now. You'll see there is this map that just sort of shows you where we have built that, you know, primarily we are in Hennepin and Ramsey County, but that in the past recent years when the housing market was so tough, we did move into the suburbs and we're building new units of housing out there. And I will say there have been really tremendous work that's been done in the suburbs, communities that have been very welcoming to low-income families and very supportive of bringing them into their communities. And so that's been an exciting development. What I wanted to, you know, after the sort of the overview of this Habitat's model of low-income family homeownership, is sort of explain to you how we use public financing. And so in your packet, you'll see two pages that have houses on them. And the first one is projected new home construction costs. And we sort of divide it up into how much it costs for the land and how much it costs for the construction. And on a whole, we use public financing for land acquisition. So when we build a new unit of affordable housing, we spend about $40,000 in public funds to purchase the land. And using those public funds to purchase the land allows us to have an affordable unit of housing. And then the other sort of 137,000 roughly We get that from private donations, from corporations, from foundations, from housing funds. And in addition to that, it is also from the mortgage payment from the homeowners. So they are constantly making payments back to Habitat, and we take those mortgage payments, and we're able to then invest that into other homeowners' mortgage payments. So we feel like it is a really good return on public dollars when we invest, you know, $40,000 of public dollars, but then, you know, triple that in sort of public or private and corporation and foundation contributions. So that is, you know, we generally say an average cost of a Habitat home is about $185,000. Now, if you look at the next page, which is projected rehab construction costs, one of the reasons that I include this sort of in the presentation is there's a lot of debate right now over, do you build new units of affordable housing? Do you just rehab foreclosed current housing? You know, how do you invest your public dollars, and how do you split it up? And so when you look at the page on the projected rehab construction costs, we're looking at acquiring a foreclosed house at about $55,000 a unit. And these are, when Habitat rehabs foreclosed lots, we are going to put a low-income family in there, someone who is below 50% of the average market index, AMI. And we have a 30-year mortgage with them at 0%. So we want this family to be able to afford to stay in this home for a very long time. So when we rehab foreclosed homes, we don't just put a coat of paint on it, hang a few new windows. We, you know, most of these homes are built pre-1940, so they have lead paint, they have asbestos insulation, they have crumbling foundations, they have old boilers, they have old roofs. We can't make this model work by putting a low-income family into a home that then has to put a new roof on 3 years later. And so we really spend quite a bit, almost $103,000 in rehabbing, making this a healthy, safe, long-term, affordable unit of housing. So, and my land acquisition guys made me promise that I would say that this is if we cherry-pick the foreclosed houses, that we find sort of the ones that are in the best condition, that those are the ones that are going to cost $55,000 to acquire them, but then they're still going to cost sort of over $100,000 in fixing them up. And so I think that there's the perception that you can go in and find these empty homes and fix them up cheaply and then put a low-income family into them. And that's not always the case. Many of the foreclosed homes that are out there have really experienced a lot of distress. Copper pipes have been pulled out, things like that, that would cost even more for us to fix. So the other piece, this appraisal gap at the top, you know, so we estimate that bringing a foreclosed home back online as an affordable unit of housing costs, you know, almost $180,000. $158,000. Most of these homes are then appraised at $130,000 because of the neighborhoods they're in, the places where foreclosures are happening. So we are already, our loan to the family is more than the value of the house. And that's one of the reasons we're in the problem we are right now in the real estate market. And so while we are appreciative of the emphasis on foreclosed housing and bringing folks those online, and the resources from NSP and HUD to do that, it's not the solution. I think that we still need to be building new units of housing, and in addition to doing work on foreclosed lots, because that is what the Challenge Fund has always allowed us to do, is that it's a flexible amount of funding for the construction of new units. And I think that we have to be working on the foreclosed units, but also we can't stop the development of new units at the same time. And I think I saw a question, so I'll pause.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I'm sorry I don't know your name. But I'm just wondering, does Habitat have, or are you thinking about developing sort of a mid point in working with some of these homes? What I'm getting at is that I know that with regard to using reclaimed materials, either things that are off-spec or whatever through the Minnesota Materials Exchange Program and others that are like that, working with building contractors. In the past, it seems like Habitat has been less interested in taking, you know, doors from a house, for instance. And I recognize that, you know, putting old things in sometimes isn't saving any money. However, in the in the situation that we're in right now, granted there are less opportunities for those reclaimed materials, but somewhere between, you know, the new home construction and maybe rehabbing the old ones, or maybe part of that rehab, I would like to know what Habitat is doing to look a little more at some of the things that maybe you're selling in the restores or whatever, as part of a way to get through this economic situation that we're in.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, sure. I appreciate the question, and you bring up a good point. I didn't mention the restore. So Habitat has a for-profit company called the Restore, where we take donated, unused, and slightly used construction materials and basically have a small Home Depot of sort of recycled from construction, and we were able to sell them at profit. And Representative Taylor was instrumental, I think, in starting the Restore up in your area. I think there's been two emphases. The growing of the Restore and our being able to easily accumulate and store and reuse used and unused construction materials has helped us be able to do that. Before, we just didn't have the opportunity to take in windows from somebody and then get them out to a site where they fit. Now we have a place where we can store them. So I think that that's becoming easier for Habitat to do. And then the other thing is that we are more and more, each unit we build is greener, to be quite honest. You know, our standards have gotten higher. We've learned how to do it better, more effectively. And part of building greener is using more of the pieces. So you're right, it hasn't always been our practice in the past, and I think it took us a little bit to get there, but we're definitely getting there. And I think that one of our things is still the struggle of finding pieces from other homes, windows, doors, whatever, that are old, that are up to green standards. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if, excuse me, this question is, but well, I'm going to start with you, and you may not know the answer.
Okay.
But over the past several years, I've watched Habitat for Humanity, you know, in my area. I've worked on two or three of the houses, and it's been a worthwhile venture. But now that I see bills coming forward, and like your bill, Representative Clark, or Madam Chair, and others, and I hear about the federal stimulus package and how we're going to have some more money and do some things. Homes and homelessness is much more visible in Representative Clark's district than it is maybe in Representative Saylor's or mine, because the homes are hidden by the trees, or we don't see those things. But my question, I guess, is it's great that there's a Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. How can our folks that work hard at this, scratch for dollars, can't find money, how can they reach for a part of that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow so we can get some? I know when we talk about the new constitutional amendment and how money will be divided in parks and trails between the metro and rural, and we talk about transportation funding being divided between the metro and the rural, I never hear anything about rural Minnesota getting any part of low-income housing funds or anything like that. So could you help me and tell me where I can send my people?
Madam Chair, Representative House, I think that Minnesota Housing, the finance agency, plays a key role in distributing housing funds outside of the metro area. So I would maybe point to Assistant Commissioner Orr, and in answering that question, you know, we are the affiliate for the Twin Cities area, and there are affiliates across the state. But I do think that there is work being done on affordable units of housing outside of in greater Minnesota. And that's about as far as I could guess.
Representative House, I think what you're saying is you'd like to know more about the Habitat for Humanity's presence in greater Minnesota, too. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sure, yes, I would. Or any area where we do low-income housing or rehabs, or even weatherization or whatever, it would be nice to know. Maybe your staff could have them give us a report as to how the money's distributed, because if we have statutes that say how we spend the gas tax, and if we're going to have funds from the federal stimulus package or any other areas. Maybe we need a statute that says some of it has to go to rural Minnesota.
Mr. Kahn, I don't know if you need to answer this, but Representative Hall, we have had in our discussion with the commissioner and the commissioner, we can bring it right down right now if we want, but it's always been a concern of people on this committee, and I think there's a fairly clear answer to that and how that money is distributed. Ms. Ward, do you want to take just a moment and come on down? And then I think you're going to like the next bill. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm Tanya Orr with the Housing Finance Agency. Representative Howes, we, every year we distribute a program assessment report. This year it looks like this. And one of the tables that has been in this program assessment report for at least the last 15 years is a breakdown by region of the amount of money and the percentage of households, the share of households, eligible households who are served by region. So, in federal fiscal year 2008, we distributed $667 million, assisted 66,000 households, I'm rounding, and 58.9% of the money that we distributed was spent in the metro area. And the remainder of the money was spent in Greater Minnesota. And I'd be happy to give you the reasons, or I'd be happy to give you a copy of the chart.
Madam Chair, I would love a copy of the chart, because when you say, how do you say, regions in Minnesota, what was the word you used?
Madam Chair, Representative House, regions. We divide, we report on a... on the economic development regions, so okay. There are six regions in Greater Minnesota.
Well, Madam Chair, with all due respect to Representative Severson's district, he would probably be a region, and Hackensack and Pine River and Park Rapids would be rural. So, you know, it'd be nice if they spent money outside of St. Cloud and Duluth and Rochester and maybe in some of the lower.
Let's work on that together. I think we've got some common interests there. We Good. Certainly want to make sure that we get, mm-hmm. you know, the resources around the state and you know, one of the things that you and I are going to be working on again this year, the youth build. Mm-hmm. So there's some federal dollars coming. There's some ways to make sure that some of those folks that you've been working with up there, you know, get their fair share. And I'm very interested in making sure that goes statewide.
Madam Chair, we also report on a biennial basis by county the amount of assistance by three large activities, home improvement, home ownership, and rental assistance, and then the total. So we have it by county. And I believe that in our overview presentation, we provided some information and maps. I can tell you that, in general, the money is distributed not precise because we don't allocate it by region. But in general, if we look at what portion of the total state eligible population lives in a region, that region is fairly closely served in terms of the portion of the total dollars that we can distribute. So that is not to say that any region's needs are fully met. And it's not precise. So there will be years when one region may look like it's underserved or a region may look like it's overserved. But the entire state is served by the agency's assistance, and it is, I would assert, that it is currently and always has been fairly distributed throughout the state.
All right. Thank you so much. I think maybe one of the things, Ms. Beckman, that a little challenge here is for some of our members to know how Habitat is working in their communities, and so maybe that's something you can kind of help us with. I do have another question. When you were talking about Habitat going more green, does that include, you know, the whole issue of healthy housing, so that I heard you talk about lead paint and so on and those sort of things? And does it also deal with the other parts of, you know, the kind of flooring that's used and those kind of standards?
I think, Madam Chair, this is a shift within our organization within the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much on people's minds. And so they're, you know, the flooring is kind of the next thing that folks are tackling this summer. And so, yes, we are very mindful of making it a healthy house as well.
Great. Thank you so much. Representative Hayden, I think you had a question. No? Okay. And I think I appreciate your presentation, and I think telling this to make sure that people know all around the state. Appreciate the work that you folks are doing. There's such a need, and you're doing a good job. Thank you. I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Link.
Well, now we're going to hear from Representative Clark on House File 1354.
I'd like to invite up Ellen Arthur. Members, I'm going to be proposing to you that we pass House Bill 1554 for lay it on the
Representative Clark, I believe we're going to lay it over.
But I will recommend that being laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus. So, and the bill that we'll be sending to Capital Committee.
So we're laying it over for possible recommendation to the Capital Investment Division.
That's right. Okay. We'll be doing that, I believe, next week, I think. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll be doing the short list. So, basically, House File 1554 gives the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency the authority to issue up to $100 million of nonprofit housing bonds that can be used by our nonprofit organizations and our local governments, and they would be in this language would be used to acquire the land and to pre-design, design, construct, renovate, furnish, and equip affordable rental housing. And it also allows in the second subdivision the opportunity for land trusts to be involved in that whole mechanism. So I'd like to just mention, have our witnesses today kind of make the case for this, and we have a good discussion about this. There's a few questions that I have to get answered in terms of myself of how this committee deals with some of the debt service, but that's something I'm working on right now with the chairs of the bonding committee. So, Mr. Arthur, if you'd like to start and go ahead and talk about what you think we can do with these bonds.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Lane, or Chairperson Lane, I should say, and committee. My name is Alan Arthur, and I'm from an organization called AON, A-E-O-N. We're a nonprofit provider of affordable homes, affordable apartment homes for people in the Twin Cities area. AON is one of the leading nonprofit providers of affordable apartment homes for people in the Twin Cities area. We have 1,700 apartment homes for people. We've created more apartment homes for homeless people than any organization in the state of Minnesota. Interestingly, we've also done more historic preservation than any organization in the state of Minnesota. We have been around now for 23 years. In the homeless side, one of the places we've done is a project for homeless teenagers, one of the first in the country when we did it back in 1995-96. And we've done a second one for homeless teenagers in our community, and we're working on a third right now. I've been the head of AON for now 21 years, very excited about that, and still excited to do the work we do. I often start out with four words: air, water, food, home. Home is pretty high on the need scale for human beings. And it is what our organization is about. And I think it's what Minnesota Housing and everybody who works on these issues, whether it be Habitat for Humanity or the Housing Trust folks are going to come talk here in a few minutes, is about. It's understanding that home is pretty high in what takes to make good community for us all. And it's what we're trying to do. And it's what for example, the bond money that this body passed last year helped us do. We're working on 60 more units for homeless individuals in our community right now. Homeless individuals who have chemical dependency problems in their history and are trying to find a way to make home for themselves in a stable environment that supports their chemical dependency problems. And we've done a wide range of other types of projects, serving a wide range of folks. We just completed a $24 million project in Chaska, affordable project. And this kind of resource, this kind of funding tool represented by the bond proposal here in front of you is the kind of resource that helps make that happen. I often refer to the group of resources that make these kinds of redevelopments and developments happen as a three-legged stool. One of those legs is federal, typically in that state is the low-income housing tax credit. The other leg is state and local, and these kinds of funds from a variety of programs from Minnesota Housing are absolutely critical to make homes possible for people. And the third leg of the stool are private and other organizations like foundations, et cetera, especially for homeless projects, of course, to get engaged in networks to make it happen as well. Without going in detail, obviously, in a situation like we're facing today, with foreclosures, people losing their jobs, it's even more critical and more important for us to have one of those very important things, home, high on the need scale, again, for human beings, be a possibility for folks. I'm often asked, do we make people be responsible? And the way I see the world, the way we see our work, is it's important to provide the opportunity for home, but there's also expectations. Those two things have to come together to make it work. We're practical about that. Opportunity and expectation. Opportunity and responsibility. Again, without going in great detail, it's what I think most of us who work in this field understand has to happen for us to build communities and for ultimately people to be successful with home. Two-thirds of the needs out there in the community are for folks who are below 30% of area median income, the affordable housing needs. That's a huge, huge piece of it, and this bond bill will help provide more housing, more home opportunities for people than have it today. And so amidst your very difficult challenges that you have, I hope you understand how, again, important home is on the need scale in our community and how important these kinds of resources are, of course, to keep doing the kinds of things we do. I think with that, maybe I'll stop and let other folks testify, and then maybe there'll be questions for me and others.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Chair, representatives. My name is Jeff Washburn, and I'm the director with the City of Lakes Community Land Trust. We're a community land trust that serves the city of Minneapolis. Additionally, I serve as the co-chair for the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition that represents 9 community land trust organizations that really span almost the entire state in our service areas. Collectively, over the last close to 10 years, a little bit more than that, we've been able to assist 650 households purchase perpetually affordable homes in the state of Minnesota. Ironically, approximately two-thirds of those homeowners have purchased homes in greater Minnesota, and only about a third of those homeowners represent the metro area, and continue to see those numbers growing. And also, I think it's worth noting that the vast majority of the homes, of the 650 homes that we've been able to help Minnesotans purchase, have been funded in one way or another by the Community of Minnesota through the Challenge Fund, and it's been really instrumental to our organization in creating that permanent affordability and responsible home ownership. Our organizations are part of a continuum that Mr. Arthur spoke of, the organization helping folks into safe housing, and what we do is create linkages with organizations like Allen's to make sure that there is a continuum. And there's a lot of folks that are not going to be able to leave affordable rental situation and jump straight into home ownership regardless of the affordable prices that we're seeing out there in the market today. And there are organizations like ours that are very supportive home ownership organizations that are needed, and I think also needed on both sides, by households as well as the communities by which they're able to take those next steps into responsible housing. And beyond the land trust, we've had close to 100 resales of those initial 650 homes across the state, close to 100 now resales, and in almost every instance we've been able to keep those homes permanently affordable, and then we also create another ownership opportunity. So not only do we help 650 homes become permanently affordable, but in reality we've helped 750 households now into affordable home ownership. Our organizations have always required 30-year fixed rate mortgages. Homeowners nationally, a recent study demonstrated that land trust homeowners were 1/30 as likely as any other homeowner to fall into foreclosure, and a lot of that is due to not only helping folks get into a responsible home ownership opportunity, but also I think the supportive work and role that our organizations play. We require owner occupancy of those homes, and We recycle those funds through a retail formula. We also provide pre- and post-purchase training, and that's part of our expectation and agreement with the homeowner when they purchase the home. The retail formula varies by community, and it should, as it's dictated by the communities that we serve. But in essence, our dollars, the state's dollars, are tied to the title of the land. And for the purposes of potential bond funding opportunity, that ownership still is held within the hands, as we understand it, of the community land trust. So those dollars are tied to the affordability to the land, and the homeowner still needs to go out and get a mortgage. Those dollars are the dollars that are going to be recycled to help multiple generations of homeowners. The retail formula that we all use varies a little bit, but in our case, it's 25%. So if and at what point in time the homeowner ever decides to sell, the dollars that we put in to help that first homeowner stay with the property, and if the home increases in value, the homeowner would receive 25% of that increase in value. The remaining 75% rolls back into the affordability of that home, and we add it to the amount that we help the first family with. Not only helping one household, as I shared, but helping multiple households and ensuring that the investment made by the state stays in those properties. Majority of our organizations are also going to receive a decent portion of the $58 million that's being passed through the NFC fund, helping to remediate foreclosures across the state. And while this is incredibly helpful, I think we all recognize that the NFC dollars are not going to be able to do it alone. So challenge funds, I think, are going to be a necessary component of that, as well as a potential use of the bond dollars if we're able to make those work and be tied to the title of the land as it works with the land trust. I think I'll leave it at that. I would like to introduce my colleague from Rochester, Sean Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Washburn, and welcome, Mr. Allen.
Thank you. My name is Sean Allen. I'm the director of First Homes Properties in Rochester. We're a subsidiary of the Rochester Area Foundation. We've been around since 2000, and we were formed as a really an economic development program within the city of Rochester to try to bring affordable homes and starter homes to people that were coming to Rochester and the surrounding area. We serve a 30-mile radius around Rochester that were coming at the time for jobs, and really where people were having a difficult time finding housing to go along with the jobs that were being created. Since that time, we've been pretty successful, in large part because of the support of the state government and the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I can say that we are the state's largest community land trust. We have approximately, 193 homes in our land trust as of this morning. And we really are mainly a financer of starter homes. We haven't done a lot of our own development. We typically work with nonprofit, public, and mostly for-profit developers to do the work that we do. And so we really see ourselves as that economic development organization. I could just like to direct you to a sheet in your packet. I believe it's got our logo on the top, First Homes. And this is really related to the Challenge Grant Program. We received, I believe, and I'm not sure, but I think it's still the largest grant of challenge funds to a community ever. Of $3 million back in, I believe, 2000. Since that time, we leveraged over $11 million locally from the community in terms of businesses and foundations. And that additionally leveraged local city participation, not just the city of Rochester, but a 30-mile radius around Rochester. We've worked so far, I believe, in 12 communities and 7 counties in southeastern Minnesota. That amount of money, that $3 million, really has served to leverage over $78 million during that time, which is over a 1-to-19 leverage ratio. We've got 361 homes that we've served with gap loans, where we just help the families achieve affordability on those homes, and we have 193 homes, as I mentioned, in our land trust. We have had 29 resales as well, and we've also helped to finance over 370 rental apartments as well. So it comes to about 920 units in all. And I think it's just really important to note that as Rochester is a recipient of NFP funding, but at First Homes we cover a geographic area that's much larger than just the city of Rochester, and actually the NFP funds are targeted just towards the downtown core of Rochester. And it's really important to have the challenge funds and CRV program, which is the result of those challenge funds, as well as the type of bonding funds to really make the NSP funds go further, both in Rochester. But I think there's also two important things. First of all, small towns, at least in southern Minnesota, I'm not aware of what's going on in the rest of Minnesota necessarily, but in Minnesota we have towns like Mankato, Albert Lea, Austin, Northfield, Chatfield, et cetera, that have their own serious foreclosure issues right now. They maybe aren't to the same level as North Minneapolis, for instance, but rural Minnesota is hurting from some of the foreclosure issues. And because those communities aren't eligible or haven't received NSP funds, and the CRV program at this point hasn't funded anything, this year. I think it's really important to note that those communities don't have any subsidies available to try to do work and remediation of the foreclosures that are happening in their community. The second thing is redevelopment projects that are occurring in Rochester and in communities all over that we'd like to have happen. Are stunted because of this lack of funding. NSP dollars can help us purchase a house and maybe knock it down, but in order to develop that new property, or that new home, or that new series of homes, it's really difficult to find that funding. And so the challenge fund and the CRV and this bonding funding would really help to make that shortfall up. And I point you to a picture in your packet as well. I don't have a copy of that, but of a 4-unit condominium project that we recently completed in Rochester just this last summer, and that is on the site of a former, really it was a crack house, with 46 police calls to that site in the year preceding our purchase of it. And in talking with the police chief in Rochester, he points out that it doesn't matter how much we invested in that property. I personally think it does, but he says no matter what you invested, it will be returned many times over in terms of the lack of investment the city police department will have to make in terms of policing that concentration of poverty and crime. And so when you look at the NSP funds, buying foreclosed houses and knocking them down isn't enough. We need to have funding to complete the job and complete new units as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Clark?
Well, members, I'm hoping that you'll, think positively about this. We still have a few issues to solve in terms of some of the financing here, but I think there's new opportunities, and so if there's any questions, we'd like to try to...
Any questions, members? Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is actually for Mr. Arthur. I just wanted to comment a little bit more, if you would, about how your organization deals with the situation where when you have to decide with a certain amount of funding if you're going to, how you're going to prioritize whether to invest in energy systems that really give a long-term return that will, actually save some money in the long term on that, or, versus building more right away to get more people in a home that is going to probably cost more in long-term energy costs. How do you reconcile that particular choice, or is it a problem for you?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, like most things in life, there's a balance to be achieved. We won two of the three state awards for green buildings 3 years ago in the state of Minnesota, and those properties are built. We're now working with the University of Minnesota and the Green Institute on three very different properties and projects that will each have their own fairly different green, sustainable, energy-efficient program, and the University of Minnesota will help us track that over the course of time and will provide other information for us to do better in the future on that front. The typical cost of green sustainability, depending on how far you go, is somewhere between 2% and up to maybe as much as 20% more expensive, depending on how radical you go. We just put, for example, solar panels on a property we just opened up in December, and it provides all the hot water heat or a good chunk of the hot water heat for that property. So it's really a balancing act between what makes sense. One of our core values is sustainability, and that's not only sustainability from an environmental or energy standpoint, but also sustainability of affordability for the residents who are going to be living in our apartments for the next 30, 40, 50, 100 years. And so we feel like we have responsibility on that front, but of course it is a balance that we have to achieve. It's a compromise that we make, and we just try to do the best that we can with that compromise and tap into sources that are not necessarily affordable housing sources, but green and sustainable sources that we can add to the overall funding or financing of that particular property to make it work. I don't know if that answers the question. But
thank you, Mr. Arthur. Representative Severson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just a few questions, a couple comments. One is, this is, again, I think we did this last year with the $30 million. We've had a little discussion on this. I think we did it the year before that with the Gopher Stadium at $420 million. I think that was kind of the inceptor. So I'm kind of wondering, and maybe research has some numbers, in terms of what is the fiscal note as we go forward. Obviously, this $8 million for 20 years is $160 million on the tag on the general fund. And we have others that are on the same line that are outside the GO bond appropriation process. I guess I'm kind of wondering, and just throwing out to the committee for consideration, what is enough? I mean, you know, we're going above by 3%, which we've dropped down below that now with the reduction in our budget. So at some point, we're going to have to say, even these alternative forms need to kind of be weighed against the monies that are going in obligation to the general fund. Obviously, we'd all like to, you know, provide affordable housing. And I do have some questions just for some of the witnesses here. And one is, do you ever see any conflict between the private sector and affordable housing in terms of market value, in terms of, you know, you've got taxpayers who are investing into affordable housing, and then you've got that same taxpayer who is getting, you know, raked over the coals with the downturn in the economy and just trying to make his own ends or her ends meet. And, you know, if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, I think that's a very good point to make and a very good question you asked about that competition. I think each community has to figure out how it weighs those. I know in our community, the vacancy rates are going down, the communities we serve are going down, and so there's tremendous demand. I don't think there is a significant issue, certainly with our homeless housing. The private market doesn't serve that population very well, and for that matter, doesn't serve that population really on up to about 40% or 50% in most communities around the state and across the country. When you start calling affordability at 80% and 100% of AMI, then I think you start to have real conflict, and I think that's a legitimate question to ask. But most of the affordable money that comes from Minnesota Housing and other affordable money from other sources in the state do serve households below 60% of AMI, and the majority of that serve households below 50% of AMI. In the last few years, a good chunk of that has served households below 30% of AMI, which is tough for the private market to serve.
Thank you. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Washburn or Mr. Allen, can you talk a little bit about the pre- and post-purchase counseling that you do, and how does that play out? And because I think we're always concerned about people, as Mr. Arthur said, getting into home ownership that are unable to sustain it. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Washburn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hayden, for all of our land trusts, we do require that buyers go through the first-time home buyer courses provided through the Home Ownership Center affiliate organizations. We also, all of our organizations have various levels of orientation that we provide to our owners. We have an application process. And then I think most important for us, and one that we often probably don't talk enough about, is that we all also require, and I believe we all pay for the cost of our buyers to sit down and meet with an attorney, not only to review all of our documents, but whenever possible to review all of those closing documents prior to closing. That's on the pre-trip purchase side. We're at a point in time now, as well as we've grown, our organization is now up to 85 homeowners. We also really encourage our homeowners to sit down and meet with one or two or more of existing land trust homeowners so they can ask questions face-to-face of them and take the staffing role out of those discussions. On the back end, we, as we've grown as well, have really built in and continue to build in a number of resources, partnering with organizations that provide post-purchase resources, but also providing ongoing training. This year, I believe we're providing 7 post-purchase courses that range from budgeting to plants, to property taxes, understanding your property taxes, understanding what you need to know about if you purchase a home in an association. What are those rights and responsibilities of association living? We had a couple of insurance agents come in and talk about what you need to look for when you're getting homeowners insurance. A lot of things that, I know when I purchased my home, I just wanted to buy the home. And give me whatever policy is needed. But once you get into homeownership, you start to realize that you probably need to be looking a little bit more at those rights and responsibilities of what that insurance might look like. And I think this is a piece that doesn't cost us a lot of money. It does cost us a little bit of time. But creating venues for homeowners to get together, we have a half-time staff person that we feel is an absolute position that we have to go out and raise philanthropic dollars for. And her sole responsibility is connecting homeowners with one another, homeowners with community opportunities, and homeowners with the land trust. And so her sole job is making those connections. And I think that is, we talk about housing, we talk about the importance of housing, but it's about how are we weaving households that we're working with back into the community and really reweaving our communities. North Minneapolis is not going to get better if we just focus on tearing down and rehabbing homes. We got to focus on the people component, and that piece of it is making sure that they're there, not only for their housing needs, but also looking to integrate with other services in the community.
Thank you, Mr. Washburn. Any other questions, members? Mr. Rosenthal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this question is for Mr. Allen. I'm looking at this 1-to-19 leverage, and that is astounding to me. And can you talk about that a little more and see how we can, or if you have any ideas how we can bring that further along throughout the state, other than Rochester and your areas, because it's phenomenal.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I thank you. We started off with a goal to be a leveraging organization. We come from a foundation background at the Rochester Area Foundation, and foundations like to talk about leverage. And I think when you... The Challenge Fund, as I understand it, was set up exactly to leverage funding from local governments and local philanthropic organizations. And I think it's been very successful from what our experience, but also from experiences I've heard of throughout the state. You look at a small town like Kenyon, for instance, they're doing the same thing. Holdcraft there, I think, has done some philanthropic contributions that have been matched by Challenge Funds, for example. I think it's happening already. I think where we started at a little different place than most organizations is we had the Mayo Clinic to help us really kick that off. And so we received, of that $11.2 million, $7 million of that was from Mayo Clinic, and it was really critical to have that local business that saw the need not just for their own business, but for the community in general. Many affordable housing, especially employer-assisted housing programs, typically only assist the employees of that particular institution. And Mayo, in this case, and I think I've seen others, like Bullcraft, for instance, they have done a good job of saying this is a community issue. Housing is a community issue, and it's also an economic development issue. And there's each of these businesses has multiple businesses that really rely on it. For instance, Rochester, I think, has more hotel rooms than St. Paul. And so you think about the hospitality industry there, those are the people that we're serving. And I guess I'm not sure how to do a better job. I'd be happy to look into it. I think Minnesota Housing really has done a lot more over, as I've seen, at least from our perspective, they've done a lot more about requiring leverage. And I think that's been a very responsible use of public funds.
Obviously taking good advantage of it, and I think you could serve as a model for others across the state on how to get these kinds of things done. And I have one quick question for Mr. Arthur. We've met briefly, and you've talked about the number of shovel-ready projects ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And could you speak a little bit to them and what, if anything, is needed to get them going besides funding coming from the state right now?
Mr. Arthur.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are actually quite a few shovel-ready projects across the state. We have three right now that we're working with a wide variety of funders, lenders, foundations, and others to do, including one of the projects I mentioned earlier, which is 60 units for homeless folks with chemical dependency, but also a couple of other properties, one in Roseville, for example, that had more crime calls than any projects, existing projects in the city of Roseville, and the city of Roseville has been working with us to, first of all, we had purchased it from the very bad landlord who was operating it at that time, and we turned it around from a social and management standpoint, but now we have to recapitalize that old, tired, not very well, in very good condition property. So we have three ourselves, 3 properties, and we're working hard with the Minnesota Housing, obviously, to get them done. I was asked by a reporter the other day, do you feel like they're not going to get done? We're, 90% there. In today's climate, getting the last 10%, a different situation than it was 3 years ago. I feel confident that all of our funders and lenders will help us make those three happen and help create a whole bunch of jobs in the meantime, which I think is a really important aspect of the kind of work that we all do, making sure people are working in this construction industry, in this home industry, in this real estate industry. What I really worry about is not these particular three in a selfish view, but if we don't have enough capital out there, there's a bunch of other projects that won't get done. And speaking about greater Minnesota, those are going to be even harder to make happen, and I worry about those. And so, there's I think 15 or 20, or maybe more shovel-ready projects out there like ours that we have to find ways, I think, to get done for a bunch of reasons, including the job side. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Arthur. Representative Rosemont.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the number of units, not just including yours, is approximately how many? And do you know a corresponding job number to go with that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I wish I could. I will get that information to you. I do have that. I didn't bring it with me. I don't have it on top of my head right now. I'm struggling to think through my poor brain to remember it, but I do have it. And we can get that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Arthur, does that relate to this handout we're just getting on pipeline housing projects in Minnesota? Yeah.
Madam Chair, I bet it is. I bet it does.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, you're getting a couple documents from the Minnesota Housing Partnership that does list throughout the state some of the so-called shovel-ready opportunities. And my understanding is also that in addition to looking and here, you'll be getting a list in, we'll each be getting a list in our offices of those that are in our own district. So it's a way to kind of begin to answer some of that question, I think. There's been some numbers that MHRA have put out. I believe that for every $1 million spent on housing, whether we're talking about new construction, rehab, rental assistance, it supports 16 Minnesota jobs. So that's a real number that they gave us. And I know that, we have so many unemployed people who are in this business sitting on the bench right now and doing housing. Fixing housing is fixing the economy, as has been going to phrase a lot around here recently with the folks who have been pushing this. We really have to address that. And I think some of you might have heard today that one bit of good news, economic news, is that housing starts are up in February. And everybody was kind of surprised, I think, about that, at least the reporters who were talking about it on the radio this morning. So there's some hope out there. There's maybe some good and bad reasons for that happening. But hopefully if we do the investment, to build like this, we'll be able to create more jobs and create more housing, and the two really go together.
I have one question on, you had spoken about today's climate, harder to get leverage money to assist you as partners. How dependent are you on communities or businesses or foundations to assist, and how much is that tightening up?
Madam Chair, it depends on the community. In some communities, it's critical for us to have that support. It's always critical to have the political support of the community, and it is often critical to have the financial support. And on the foundation side, there is a tightening. There's no question about that, which will make it harder. I think it will ultimately mean that there'll be fewer people served. There's no question about that. So I think our collective community goal has to be to make that as small as impact as possible.
Thank you.
Chair, I'd like to renew my motion.
Well, we'll just lay over the bill for possible recommendation to the Capital Investment Division. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, I noticed that Mr. Arthur had a very unusual button on him. He shouldn't let the time pass without those of us who are part Irish to celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Okay. Representative Saylor, would you like to move the minutes?
Certainly, Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Saylor moves the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Thank you. Minutes are moved.
Thank you.
Give it a
meeting is adjourned. You want to do that?
And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.